I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Missouri has one of the highest rates of gun deaths in the nation. Kansas City and St. Louis know it, as they're experiencing what's been called the slaughter of children in our state. Both cities have asked state lawmakers to help reduce firearm-related death, but the Republican-controlled State House has failed to act. Today, Republican senators answer questions about what they intend to do to reduce gun violence in Missouri. Then, a woman beekeeper in Macedonia, lighthouse keepers in New England, and the electrical war between Edison and Westinghouse. Our film critics tell you which of these and other cinematic tales are worth seeing. We'll get you up to date after the news. Republicans in Missouri remain reluctant to pull the trigger on gun legislation, so what is the path forward? Now a conversation with two Republican state senators about what they would support and what they expect the GOP-controlled General Assembly to do next year. All this comes as a spate of gun violence on the streets of Kansas City and St. Louis continues unabated and as residents continue to demand action. Just this week, Governor Mike Parson was in town to meet with city leaders on the issue. One item of discussion was improving mental health treatment across the state as one way to approach this issue. With us are Republican State Senators Bill Eigel of Weldon Spring and Tony Luchtemeyer of Parkville. Senator Eigel, welcome to the show. Nice to have you.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Senator Luchtemeyer, welcome back. Always good to have you, too.
Good to be here, Steve.
Well, let's get right into this. Senator Luchtemeyer, city leaders in Kansas City and St. Louis are continuing to call for the right to limit gun possession in their cities, which are on fire, of course, with gun violence. I'm wondering, what are the prospects of a bill passing that would give cities the right to enact gun legislation that might be different than what's in place around the rest of the state?
Yeah, so I personally think the likelihood is not very good mm-hmm. in the legislature for that to happen.
Why is that?
Well, there are a combination of factors. The first is, you know, if you look at the gun ownership around the state, I think nobody would dispute that there are more guns owned in rural Missouri, yet this happens to be a issue that's specific to the cities and the problems that they're having. What that shows to me is that somebody who is a law-abiding citizen, which the overwhelming majority of gun owners are law-abiding citizens, that if they're in a dangerous area, one of the justifications for having a gun and for the Second Amendment and to have those rights is for self-defense. And so you have a greater need in Kansas City and St. Louis than you do in the rest of the state. And so I think infringing on gun rights in areas where there is the most vulnerability among the population is not the right policy decision mm-hmm. to go.
Senator Eigel, do you agree with that assessment that gun legislation probably will not advance next session?
Yeah. In fact, I would take it a step further than just probably. I think there's zero chance that gun legislation will advance in the legislature next year because I've never believed, and Senator Luchtemeyer did a good job of expressing this, but I've never believed that expanding restrictions on those that are not committing crimes does really anything to prevent those that are willing to commit a crime from continuing to do so. And I think the whole discussion that we've started here this morning, it's almost like it's got off onto the right foot. You know, when we talk about the term gun violence, you know, gun violence is a political term. It's a term that's used to take personal responsibility of a criminal few to an agenda that's really just trying to take away the individual rights of the many that are following laws. Mm-hmm. So blaming guns by using a term like gun violence, that's like blaming forks for obesity. And if we don't walk around trying to address obesity by referring to it as fork obesity or spoon obesity, and most of these bans and restrictions that are being listed as ways to try to address a restriction on firearms, they're not actually addressing the problem. So I would be pessimistic that we're going to try to address this problem simply by curtailing the rights of those that are following the law right now.
Right. You know, before we walk away from this idea, Senator Luchtemeyer, you do get a sense that the leader of your party, Governor Mike Parson, is at least willing to have a conversation about what to do about guns in the big cities. Will that have much influence on senators?
Well, look, you know, I can only comment on the things that I've read that the governor has said, and I don't think that I've heard him say that he's looking at any type of gun legislation that would curtail the Second Amendment rights of law-abiding citizens. I think what he has talked about is that there is a critical need in the state of Missouri to find policies outside of restricting gun rights to make our city safer. You know, and one of the things that he put forward as an initial first step was to authorize the Highway Patrol to supplement some of the policing efforts that are going on in St. Louis. I think there have been similar discussions about moving forward with doing that in Kansas City.
I think leaders here have said no thanks.
That's right. That's right. That's my understanding is that leaders in Kansas City have said no. And I think the governor will continue to be focused on, as will the legislature, continue to be focused on what are the things that we can do in terms of reforming our criminal code and others to reduce violent crime in our metro areas. I don't think any Republican would dispute the fact that we have an issue with violent crimes in our major metro areas. I mean, Kansas City right now, after a recent USA Today report, was listed as the number five most violent city in the state. St. Louis was number one. And surprisingly, I think
most violent city in the country, you mean?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. The most violent city in the country.
Right.
And then Springfield was number 12. And so we're one of only, I think, two states that have three cities in the top 25 most dangerous cities list. So there is something that needs to be done. But I think there are other things that we're going to be focused on to try to rein in violent crime in the cities.
You know, Senator Igoe, when you hear stats like that, what's your sense of what's behind that? Because one might conclude that there's something going on in the state of Missouri that's causing as much violence as we're seeing here. What's your sense?
Well, if we want to address violence, and I agree with Senator Lugdemeyer, that's what we want to do. And I think that there's a call for government to do something. But when I look at it, in more of a long-term view of why are we seeing crimes being committed? And generally, you see crimes being committed in areas that are associated with areas that are economically depressed. And it's you see them in areas where there's a lack of economic opportunity. So my question over the long term is, what policies can we enact here in the state of Missouri that will provide economic opportunities to our urban areas and our rural areas so that folks naturally aren't turning to crime as an alternative to support their way of living?
I want to talk to you about that some more, Senator Igoe, but, sure. But help me understand, though, what's happening in Missouri that causes three of our biggest cities to be at the top of the national rankings when it comes to violence? What's happening in Missouri?
It's an indication that the economic opportunity of those areas is not where it needs to be. I'll continue to expand on that. If you have, and again, we're talking about the urban areas, if you have places that are stagnant, that aren't growing, where people can't find a job and where people can't find opportunity and move their socioeconomic status, there's more of a likelihood that they're going to turn to a life of crime. And that leads to the kind of outcomes that we're seeing in our urban areas right now. I'm over in the St. Louis side of the state, and St. Louis City right now is one of the fastest shrinking areas of the city. So people are leaving the city, and the folks that aren't leaving the city are the ones with the least means to be able to change their socioeconomic status. So if we don't enact policies that address that over the long term, we're not going to see any change in the crimes that are being committed and the efforts that are going on to try to address this by simply putting more restrictions on folks that aren't committing crimes. I just think that's the wrong way to go.
Senator Lugdemeyer, just to stay with this, are there two or three initiatives? I know the Republican caucus just met the other day to talk about bills and priorities for the 2020 session. But when it comes to giving the inner cities a boost economically, what kinds of things might you be looking at?
Yeah, so absolutely. You know, I think, and first of all, let me say that I agree with everything that Senator Igoe just said. I think a lot of the issues that we're having in the urban areas that's distinct from maybe some of the areas in rural Missouri is the lack of economic opportunity. And when people, you know, lack educational opportunities, they lack economic opportunities, a lot of the times they will turn to crime and violence because that's the only way that they see out of that system.
And just to be, you know, some listening might conclude, though, that other cities are in the same boat, but they don't have as much violence as we have in Missouri.
Yeah. And so, and that's actually a segue into one of the things that I want to talk about on the show, which is what are the things that we can do here and now? I mean, a lot of boosting economic opportunities for people, which while a laudatory goal and is definitely something that we should focus on, it's long-term, it's difficult to define. But whenever we're talking about the here and now, I think reforming our criminal justice system in meaningful ways to crack down on violent crime in cities and elsewhere around the state is critically important. So, for example, the state has an armed criminal action statute, also known as ACA. What it is it's a penalty enhancement. So if somebody uses a dangerous weapon, whether that's a knife, whether that's a gun, to commit a dangerous felony, that serves as an enhancement to the penalty for that underlying offense.
But it's often not employed, though, right?
Correct. Well, what will oftentimes happen is the prosecutor will charge someone with an ACA, but then what will happen is the judge will run their sentences concurrently. So what that means is, let's take, for example, kidnapping. You could kidnap someone without using a dangerous weapon. If you commit kidnapping and you use a dangerous weapon, I think most people would agree that that makes the crime more significant, more severe. So if you get convicted of kidnapping and the jury sentences you to 5 years and you get a 3-year sentence for an ACA, if a judge runs it concurrently, that means you only serve 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Now, most people would say, well, logically, if you get a 3-year sentence for ACA and you get a 5-year sentence, then you should serve 8 years total, which is known as consecutive sentencing. The whole purpose of a criminal enhancement like the ACA, which is the entire reason that it exists, is that judges should be running them consecutive. The courts have over time reinterpreted, in my view, that statute. I think the statute right now requires consecutive sentencing, but it has been interpreted to not require that. And so I think some amendments to that statute are really important in curbing violent crime, particularly when people are using weapons to effectuate
There's also a street gang statute that you all are looking at.
Yeah, so the feds have what a lot of listeners would be familiar with, which is the RICO statute, or at least most people have heard of RICO. It was a federal crime statute that was used to take down the mob and a lot of other organized criminal networks at the federal level. Missouri has what some people refer to as a little RICO statute that focuses specifically on street gang. And if you look at, you know, the urban core as compared to rural Missouri, one of the things when it comes to violent crime where there is a difference is there's a lot more organized crime, whether that's mm-hmm. around drug dealers or gangs, in city areas than in rural areas. Most of the time when somebody, you know, shoots up a building in a drive-by, that's not an isolated incident. This isn't just, you know, a lone person right. acting on their own. They're part of a broader criminal network. And so we have a statute in Missouri that the legislature passed, I think it was back in the 70s or 80s, modeled it off of a California act, which California had used to great success in curbing violent crime in LA County. Missouri made some changes to that model act whenever we implemented it in the 70s and 80s and made it really difficult to prosecute a case under that statute. Mm-hmm. So what I would like to do
make it
reasonable so that prosecutors actually use it, because most of the prosecutors I've talked to have said, look, it's so difficult to prove a case under the statute, it's not even worth our time prosecuting it.
If you're just joining us here, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're talking with two Republican state senators from Missouri about what to do about violence in Missouri. Senator Bill Eigel joins us from Eastern Missouri. Senator Tony Luchtemeyer from north of Kansas City in the Parkville area joins us here. If you have a question for our guests, 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Senator Eigel, you were talking about ways to boost the economic prospects of inner cities. What mm-hmm. kinds of things might be on your agenda going forward?
Well, I tend to take a longer view. And by the way, I think Tony was spot on in the fact that he has identified some things. And by the way, he's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee in the Missouri Senate. And he did present everything that he just described to the caucus this week. And I think it was very well received. So I look forward to continuing that discussion with him.
Mm-hmm.
When we talk about the economic and fiscal part of it, we're also right. That's the longer term. And instead of just saying what's good for the urban areas, what's good for the rural areas, I'm looking at policies, what's good for the entire state. Mm-hmm. And I think one of the best measures that you can have of if a state is healthy or not so healthy from an economic perspective is our population growth. If our population is growing, I was a small business owner before I got into politics, and I always used to say that if you have sales, everything else can be fixed. Well, in geopolitics, if you have population growth, everything else can be fixed. Because if people want to move to your state, if they want to bring their entrepreneurial ideas, their investment dollars, their families, and they want to come to your state because the environment is productive for that, that's a good thing. So what are we not doing that other states that are growing, what are they doing? And if you look at states like Texas or Nevada or Washington State, red or blue states, by the way, what policies have they enacted that are drawing population there? It has a lot to do with our tax code. Now, I'm a fiscal guy, and I could probably spend the next hour talking about how we could change our tax code, but I'd like to get away from income taxes that literally punish workers the more successful they are. And if you move away from a structure where you're taxing income, where you're literally taxing the sweat off an individual's back, that tends to attract businesses and individuals far more than a lot of the corporate welfare programs that we see that Missouri has been doing for many years that really aren't all that effective. And if we could move more in that direction, I think that's going to get our population growing, which will help not just our urban cores, but it'll help the rural areas as well.
You know, let me just interrupt. You know, my sense, Senator, is that with all due respect, is if you're an inner city resident listening to this conversation right now, I'm sure they're shaking their heads thinking, you're not speaking to the fears and the concerns they have about daily life in the inner cities of places like Kansas City, Missouri. They're scared right now. They see their communities on fire, and they're looking for help. And I'm not sure a long-term solution when the unemployment rate is 3.2%, Senator Lucht-Meyer, is going to get you where you need to be in terms of helping those folks out.
Well, first of all, it's a combination. You have to focus on long-term economic opportunity to break cycles of poverty and to get people away from lives of crime.
And arguably, in the 20 years that Republicans have been in the majority in Jeff City, you guys have taken a lot of steps to boost the economic opportunities in the state of Missouri.
We have, and educational opportunities as well. We fully funded the foundation formula for K through 12 education for 3 years running now. We gave the first core increase in terms of appropriations for higher education. Each university saw a $1 million increase to their core funding. I think that's the first time since 2008 when the Great Recession hit, where universities actually saw a positive impact on their budget. In terms of the here and
now.
But again,
a lot of folks say you need to do a lot more.
Sure.
Higher ed in Missouri flagging behind other states, education funding, the formula was reduced a few years ago. You're only fully funding a reduced amount compared to what it used to be. A lot of people say you need to be doing a lot. Democrats would be saying that.
Sure. In terms of the issue of violent crime, because I think at the start of your question, you said, you know, what do you say to people in the inner cities who, you know, they feel like their community's on fire and they need relief right now?
Right.
That's why I'm focused on criminal justice reform issues, because I think that is the way that you impact violent crime in an immediate and significant and discernible way. And so I want to go back to, you know, one of the other things that we talked about during caucus, and something that you'll appreciate from having been on the editorial board at the Kansas City Star. The Star in 2014 did a 7-part series on violent crime in the city. And one of the many themes that was picked up as a part of that editorial was that there was a high number of judges who were granting probation to violent offenders. Mm-hmm. And in fact, there were 6 examples, I think, in the article in recent years where somebody who's convicted of second-degree murder was given probation. They didn't spend a single day in prison, and they were back out on the streets. Mm-hmm. Now, the recidivism rate among violent offenders in the urban core is 42%. Right? So nearly half of these people are reoffending. You know, we don't even have to look back more than a week or two ago with both of the people who were involved in the KCK shooting. I mean, both of those people were out on probation. One of the guys could have been sentenced to up to 8 years in prison, was given probation, was out, and then they shoot and kill 4 people.
Well, one of the problems we have here is the lack of jail space, both at the city and the county levels here in Jackson County.
Right. But that's not an excuse for not incarcerating people. We can't just say, well, we don't have enough space, so we're going to let violent people who we know are going to go back out on the streets, commit shootings and other violent crimes, let them back out. And so there needs to be, I think, a wholesale review of the way that we handle probation in the state. And I think there's some common sense ones. You know, right now we do not allow probation for only 3 crimes that I'm aware of, capital murder, which is first-degree murder.
Right.
We don't allow it for any child sex crimes, and then we don't allow it for ACA, which is the Armed Criminal Action Statute we've talked about before. But second-degree murder, that's an offense that a judge can grant probation for. By the way, if somebody's sentenced, they have to serve 85% of their sentence before they're eligible for parole. But if a judge on the front end says you don't have to spend a single day in prison, you can get a slap on the wrist and you're back out on the street.
Senator, before I go to some phone calls here, just real quickly, I haven't heard you guys talk about mental health reform, mental health funding. Is that part of the equation going forward in your view?
Yes, of course it is. Now, I will say that our mental health funding right now from the state level is at a level that is greater than it's ever been at. And by the way, when we talk about, you mentioned school funding, a lot of times the funding, you know, more funding doesn't necessarily equal the outcomes that people are thinking that more dollars are going to give them. We have record amounts of spending going on in Jefferson City on everything from mental health to education to social programs to welfare programs. We have record spending in every one of those areas. And yet all that spending is not translating to the kind of outcomes that people are demanding more and more from government. Well, the answer is necessarily not even more government. The answer has to do with economic opportunity and freedoms that we've been getting away from the more and more involved our government has gotten. Now, Tony did a really good job, I thought, and I'm not sure where we lost this in translation. Tony did a really good job of describing what some of the short-term things we can do to address violence in our cities. And I think we're going to be moving forward with that, but there's certainly a place for the longer term economic discussion of how do we get all of Missouri, not just the urban areas, not just the rural areas, how do we get all of Missouri growing again? And I think it's a combination of both. But yes, I'd be surprised if there's any reduction in funding for mental health institutions in the state. I'd be surprised if there's any reduction in education funding, but more government is not necessarily the answer. So we've got to start finding ways to get away from the idea that government can fix all these problems from Jefferson City or from Washington, D.C., because that's just not, that's not realistic.
Let's go to some phone calls here. Kim from Kansas City, Missouri. Kim, you're on with Senators Igel and Lucht-Demeyer. Good morning.
Good morning. My biggest question is, with the ACA, do we have any research that says that these people who have guns will actually, in the heat of the moment, be like, oh, not going to use my gun because I might get 3 more years in prison?
Senator Lucht-Demeyer, you were talking about that idea. What do you think?
Yeah, so that's a good question. So this is one of the things you debate whenever you're in law school, the theories behind criminal punishment and why you punish people. And one of the most widely accepted theories of criminal punishment is deterrence. Right. And the idea is that if somebody sees someone that they know go to prison with a lengthy sentence, they are deterred from committing crimes in the future. The other theory of punishment is incapacitation. The idea that if somebody is violent, they're more likely to reoffend. And so taking them off the street and putting them behind bars is the best thing we can do from a societal perspective. Mm-hmm. So they have an opportunity to reform themselves. That's why we call it the Department of Corrections. It's not called the Department of Prisons. The idea is you go to prison and you get reformed. So is this something that will work to get people from recommitting or committing crimes in the first place? I think the answer to that is unquestionably yes, that it will. You want evidence that it works? Look at the 1994 omnibus crime bill that Congress passed whenever Newt Gingrich and President Clinton were in office. Part of that was mandatory minimum sentencing, tough on crime, types of things that were being done at the federal level. And we saw double-digit reductions in violent crime nationwide. So these things do work. I think right now the problem is the message that people on the streets of Kansas City and St. Louis who are committing violent offenses, the message that they're getting is, well, you know, my buddy went into the Jackson County justice system, got a slap on the wrist and was back out. That is not the message we need to be sending. And if I might take just one more moment. I had a meeting with our Kansas City police chief, Rick Smith, who was talking to us about, when people will run afoul of the law and commit what they thought was a state crime, but then because of the number of, whether it's a federal felon in possession or some other type of offense that triggers federal jurisdiction, these people will all of a sudden realize, like, uh-oh, I'm going to go to the U.S. Attorney's office now and be prosecuted federally.
Right.
And that clicks with them. There was a story that he told me about a guy who thought that he had committed a crime that was going to be prosecuted in Jackson County. They pick him up. They start driving him to what he thought was the Jackson County jail. They go up to the federal courthouse. And he said, well, where are we going? I thought we were going to Jackson County. And they said, no, you committed a federal crime. You're getting prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney's Office. The guy tried to commit suicide in his cell that night. So that just shows you the emotional impact that tough on crime legislation has on people.
Jane from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Good morning. Tough on crime. How about tough on substance use disorders? I worked as a counselor doing counseling for substance use disorders in two Missouri maximum security prisons. And I know that more than half of the people in prison are there because of violent crimes related to their drug abuse problems. We need more funding in Missouri for substance use disorders. We are at the crossroads of the drug trade, St. Louis and Kansas City. I know because I grew up in St. Louis. Now I live in Kansas City.
Let me get a thought here, Jane, from Senator Igel. Senator Igel, respond to what Jane's saying, if you would.
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that the commitment from Jefferson City to substance abuse programs for corrections programs is all at record levels. We have never spent more dollars than what we have. And yet Jane actually talks about, in spite of those record levels of funding, she's not seeing the outcomes that she'd like to see. So I'm not, you know, at the same time when you're saying record funding is not really giving you what you want, but you want more funding. I think there's a disconnect in what the role of state government can actually be. That's why I switch back from a long-term perspective. The way we're going to address these types of issues is by increasing the economic opportunity in the state of Missouri. That's the long-term solution. And I think, you know, I don't want to sound like a broken record for Tony put a lot of possible short-term solutions out there. But again, we have record funding in the state, and we have had record funding for the better part of a decade. And if that's not getting the results you're looking for, more funding may not be the answer.
Rick from Independence will be our last phone call here. Rick, if you go quickly, I'd appreciate it.
Good morning. It's just a comment. At the time the Second Amendment was written, it took 60 seconds at least to reload your musket. Now today, with modern weapons in our dense communities, theoretically, a mad person can murder 60 people in 60 seconds. We have to rewrite the Constitution.
Senator Lucht-Meyer, just a quick comment, if you would.
So most violent crime in America is actually committed with knives and handguns. I don't hear any conversation at the state or the national level that we should be banning those weapons. I think what we need to do if we want to get serious on violent crime is we need to be talking about some of the things that I've been talking about, making sure that people are appropriately punished, making sure that we're sending a message to the criminal community that if you use a gun or a knife or commit violence on somebody, that will not be tolerated in the state of Missouri.
We're going to have to leave our conversation there. I want to thank our Republican state senators, Bill Igel from Weldon Spring over just north of St. Louis. Tony Lucht-Meyer from Parkville represents a district north of the river. Gentlemen, thank you so much for your time. I sure appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us, yeah.
After a short break, we'll talk with our film critics about some films you've got to check out in the next couple weeks. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Before you start your weekend, make sure you sign up for my newsletter, Kraske Off Mic. Subscribe at kcur.org/Kraske. And each Monday, you'll get thoughts from me and highlights from the entire up-to-date team. It's easy. Just go to kcur.org/Kraske. Monday on the show, caring for someone who is mentally ill can take its toll. We'll hear one caretaker story and get tips from an expert on handling those hardships. That's Monday on KCUR. Up to date. Well, the International Kansas International Film Festival opens in a couple of weeks, and we'll give you a rundown about that in just a moment. Also on tap this morning from our film critics, the highly decorated new film now showing at the Tivoli at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. Lots to talk about with our film critics, and today they are Cindy Haynes. Cindy, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Steve Walker's back.
Steven, I am. Thank you.
And Beck Ireland. Beck, nice to have you again.
Thanks for having me.
Well, Steve, tell us about the Kansas International Film Festival taking place at the Glenwood Arts Theater in a couple weeks.
Well, it's a yearly event that Brian Mossman does over there, and it starts 11-8, the 8th of November. Mm-hmm. There's, 120 films?
150.
But who's counting?
From 29 countries. Yeah. I've seen some of the documentaries, and there's a couple that are really, really good, but I would just encourage people to go to kansasfilm.com. You can get a pass and festival it that way, as with festival as a verb.
Yeah. Is this a must go to for film critics like you guys? Beck, is that you going to be there?
I'm not, but I think it is a great thing to do.
It's good for the city. I think it. Yeah. We need something like that.
And a lot of the filmmakers come in, and so it's a pretty prestigious.
And there's going to be several big movies. The Terrence Malick new one is going to be showing there, so it's a good place to see that.
Good place to see. And then the Tivoli is now at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. I'm trying to get used to that myself. I went to the opening this week, and it was crowd and a lot of fun, and people were pretty excited.
Well, they are doing their first film that's showing more than once. It's called Honeyland. It's a documentary showing four times, starting tonight, I believe, or is it this afternoon?
I think there's evening and afternoon shows.
It's called Honeyland, Steve. It's one of the most amazing films you will
see
this year.
We're going to talk about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Can we go ahead and talk about it?
Well, you wanted to talk about how you feel about going to a museum to see art films based on your experience at the El Paso Museum of Art. Yeah.
That would be
you.
Me.
Okay.
And it's true. I remember as a young kid going to the Sunday afternoon screenings of foreign and art films at the El Paso Museum of Art, and that was the beginning of my interest in talking about movies the rest of my life.
We went to the drive-in. I did not go to the museum.
Yeah. Well, let's go to this documentary titled Honeyland. It's, again, filmed in Macedonia, of all places. Features a woman who apparently is one of the last beekeepers in Europe. She struggles to care for her invalid mother and bees that provide her only source of income.
This movie, I mean, both Beck and Cindy have said, I cannot believe this is a documentary, that this isn't really good actors, but it's not. They filmed it over 3 years. This woman lives in a very remote part of Macedonia, has bee hives within the crevices of a mountain that's in their village. She has them.
Yeah, I think that's an important distinction. She's not the last beekeeper. She's the last wild beekeeper.
Mm-hmm. And she takes her honey. She lives hand to mouth only on the honey that she can sell when she walks how far into the town? 20 miles or something?
Yeah, I think 25 kilometers, they said.
And then her family with seven rambunctious children moves in right next to her land, and it sets up the whole second half of the movie about her relationship with the kids, her strained relationship with the father of this family, who he decides that he's going to do bees. It's just fascinating and beautifully shot.
The other family are basically gypsies, and they've got a caravan, and there are moments I thought this has to be an actor. This cannot be happening here in front of the cameras.
Well, I don't think you could have scripted it any better for the tension.
I agree.
That goes on. I mean, and it just works on a metaphorical level of natural resources and who gets to use them and how you use them, and it's just like it works on all levels.
So a big thumbs up for Honeyland showing at the Nelson Atkins.
It's on my top 10 for sure of this year.
No kidding. That's strong. Okay, that sounds great. Beck, let's go to a film titled The Lighthouse. It's set back in the 1890s. It's about a pair of lighthouse keepers on a remote New England island. They're driving each other insane.
Yeah, so this is basically a sort of a ghost story told in a lighthouse with farts. It's basically how the filmmaker, Robert Eggers, and his brother Max, who helped him write this script, they were the two behind The Witch from 2015, the horror movie. It's not for everybody, I think. It's very much for people who are really into movies and the influences of movies. It takes the look of like a Bergman movie. There's some Shakespearean prose to it. There's Greek mythology, things like that, and basically just pits sort of Willem Dafoe as the salty, superstitious former sea captain with the young Robert Pattinson together and does all the intense things of putting two people in isolation together for weeks.
Yeah. You guys see this film?
Yes.
What'd you think?
And I agree with Beck. It's an homage to all of those people that she mentioned, and it's stunningly filmed. I think it's in black and white. It's in a square aspect ratio, so it's, I guess, the ultimate of an art film, Steve.
Well, I haven't seen it.
Oh, that's right. You haven't. Yeah. I'm sorry.
If you're looking for the film to give you answers or about the story, you're not going to find it. It's sort of purposely obfuscated of what, we don't know if we're in reality or not throughout the whole thing.
Did you enjoy the film, Cindy?
It got a little tedious for me and pretty violent, but I'm glad I saw it. I really am. I can't recommend it highly, but I mean, knowing what we've just offered in the way of an explanation of the film, if you've ever been interested in Nova Scotia or lighthouses, this is something...
Or psychological horror.
Right.
Yeah.
What's the clip we have here, Beck?
I believe it is when... Willem Dafoe is upbraiding Robert Pattinson about the upkeep of the house for the lighthouse.
This is from The Lighthouse.
What do you call that?
Sir?
What?
I mopped and swept twice over.
Ye lion dog.
Well, I swept them.
Tis begrimed and bedabbled. Unwiped, unwashed, and disdained.
Some kind of pert out of molesting me.
Come now.
I already says...
How dare ye contradict me, you dog?
Now look here. I ain't never intended to be no housewife nor slave in taking this job. And it ain't right. These lodges is more ramshackle than any shanty boys camp I ever seen. The Queen of England's old fancy housekeeper couldn't even done no better than what I done. Because I tell you, I scrubbed this here place twice over.
And sir. I say you did nothing of the sort.
Okay.
Pattinson,
the tensions are rising.
Yeah, he gave a pretty good performance, but kept falling in and out of a variety of accents. He is British, and he just wasn't as salty as Defoe's character,
right?
Thomas Wake.
Okay, so sort of a mixed set of reviews here for The Lighthouse. Let's move on to The Current War. Beck, this is about the race between Thomas Edison and George Westinghouse to determine whose electrical system would power the planet.
Yeah, this is a pretty star-studded movie. It's based on a book called The War of Currents. Mm-hmm. So basically the AC versus DC of the sort of the electrifying America in the turn of the century, the last century. So we have Benedict Cumberbatch's Thomas Edison, who is on the DC side, and then we have Michael Shannon as Westinghouse on the AC side. And, you know, there's all these arguments about what's cheaper, what's better for America, you know, and basically it's sort of a race for who gets the legacy of electrifying America.
It's a heck of a story.
Sounds like it, yeah.
But do we think it was really told well?
Well, I think... the story is much more complicated than the movie allows. It kind of just moves it along really fast. I think the most interesting part is when Edison starts playing sort of dirty pool with the facts about the other current and how dangerous it is. Mm-hmm. And he sets up this sort of negative PR campaign, and that's when he starts electrifying all the animals, and electrocuting. There's a whole other story about the first electric chair electrocution that's happening, and he wants it associated with Westinghouse. And I think that kind of distracts from the main story.
Huh. What's the clip we have here?
I believe it's when Edison and his secretary, Insull, played by Tom Holland, are talking about Edison's negative campaign against Westinghouse.
This is from The Current War.
Our future's not going to be paved with bricks, but with copper. Automation, transportation, communication, and the man that controls that current controls that future.
But you know Westinghouse is right.
You don't actually believe that a few accidents rule out the viability of his current. You just don't want to lose.
I have merely amplified what no one else was willing to take seriously.
No, what you did was run him over with a 12-ton train.
Oh, well, he's the one that's supposed to only make breaks, so who's to blame here?
Do you enjoy this film, The Current War, Cindy?
Well, it's the story itself is interesting, and I agree. There's so much to tell, and I think the emphasis often was in the wrong place when it came to telling this very interesting, complicated story.
So kind of Midland review for that, too.
But I would make an effort to see it.
Well, the movie has a very checkered history of this is actually the director's cut. It was released at a Toronto Film Festival in 2017, and then it got shelved for various reasons involving the Weinstein Company, and then the director exercised a clause in it, the contract of being able to recut it. So he actually added 5 scenes, took out 10 minutes, and I think, unfortunately, it didn't really help it.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation on the current war there. Mixed reviews for that film. If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking with our film critics this morning about the latest indie film showing around town. The critics are Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Beck Ireland today. Let's go to a film, Cindy Haynes, Judy. This is the Judy Garland biopic when she arrives in London for a five-week theatrical engagement just months before she died.
I was so interested in seeing this film. I have to say this is one of the few films I'll probably watch a second time.
Huh.
Renee Zellweger and the conversations, you know, just been praising her to the skies.
Oscar Best Actress nominee for
exactly.
sure. For sure.
And I agree with Beck. I mean, Oscars are Oscars. The performance itself is so extraordinary, I thought. I taught a class on Judy Garland, and I think I've seen every single Judy Garland interview, movie.
Wow.
And I just really felt that Renee pegged the story of Judy Garland's last days.
Wow.
Because she winds up dying,
6 months.
6 months later. Mm-hmm. And it was smart not to try to tell her entire story, to just take that segment toward the end of her life and emphasize that. But her singing is just phenomenal.
She uses her own voice.
Does Renee sing in the film herself?
She
yes.
Yeah. Sings.
Wow. She doesn't sound like Garland, but she studied her movements, her mannerisms. It's an amazing performance, unlike that overrated Rami Malek Freddie Mercury performance from last year where he lip-synced. Zellweger uses her own voice.
In an interview, she was saying she wasn't trying to necessarily imitate the big voice of Judy Garland. She was trying to get those last months, really, mm-hmm. of what it is. So it was when Judy's range wasn't as big. So
sure.
In a way, she's kind of off the hook.
Yeah.
For getting
right.
that big sound that, you know, only Judy and Liza have. So,
right.
Mm-hmm. You know.
Right. And there's, I'm sorry, I was just going to say, in Profile, you could freeze the frame and say, that's Judy Garland. That's not Renee Zellweger.
Wow.
She looks just like her.
Zellweger wants to make it clear that this is her love letter to Judy Garland.
Mm. Although it was very sad because of the state that she was in.
And there are some scenes that should have been eliminated. There's a moment with Louis B. Mayer to show the extent to which, you know, he abused her, Judy Garland. I think...
All the flashbacks. So it goes back to the time when she's filming Wizard of Oz.
Wizard
at
of
that
Oz,
time.
Is that right?
And they're really unnecessary because...
Totally unnecessary.
You know, Judy in the 1969... era is telling that story, and I think that's even more poignant when she's telling her own story.
Hmm. And they should have left it that way.
But y'all would recommend the film?
Definitely.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And I'd recommend people check out YouTube clips of the real Judy and make their own comparison.
Well, speaking of clips, we have one here, Cindy, from the film Judy. What is it?
Well, she's talking to her ex-husband, Sid Luft. Another man who took advantage of her and stole her money and created real problems. They had two children together, and Judy has spent a great part of that of her life then begging to keep her children, who are going to be taken away from her because of her erratic behavior.
This is from Judy.
No.
Come on.
No, Sid.
Judy.
No. No. I'm working harder than you would ever believe.
Are you?
And right now, my husband is making a deal for me that means I can start over.
You're not listening.
I have someone I can rely on now. Someone who's helping me make money instead of losing it at the track.
Can we not?
I'm going to get a place, and they're going to live with me. I don't want them on stage with me. I don't want them in this phony business, and I don't want them anywhere near the bastards who run it. But you have to let me be with them, Sid.
That's from the film Judy. Big kudos for Renee Zellweger's performance in this film. Let's go to a film here called Manos, Steve Walker. 8 teenagers trained to be revolutionary guerrillas. It's Lord of the Flies set in Latin America.
That's what it is. Exactly right. But they have an American hostage played by Julianne Nicholson.
Oh, she's good. She's
It's hard to explain. It's hard to understand how they got here. It seems like the world is falling apart outside of this remote area where they live. And they are then under attack By who, I'm not sure. So I keep kind of alluding to the fact that it's not everything is clear.
Mm-hmm.
But it's beautifully shot. It is Lord of the Flies. I mean, set yeah, down, on this mountain.
Down to the pig's head on the stake.
Even. Right, yeah, right. They Alejandro Landes is the director of this.
Could you consider it a fable?
I don't know. I don't know.
Did you like it?
I liked it a lot. No, it's going to be on my three to see. But it's just a little bit foggy and fuzzy about what has happened to this mountain.
They haven't even just, named the country.
No, and it never says.
So.
Okay.
So. One thing that is interesting is this eerie electronic industrial score by Micah Levi, who did the music to Jackie, if you remember how strange and hypnotic that score was. He did the music here as well, which is really a standout.
So a thumbs up from Steve Walker for Manos. Okay. I Hold in My Hands, the last film we're going to talk about today, Paradise Hills. Steve, it's about an incorrigible teenage girls are sent to an island by their parents who want to mold their daughters into perfect versions of themselves. What a concept.
And it will be the last time I ever talk about this movie.
Okay.
It's a kind of a mess, and it's kind of not sure what it wants to be. It's like, is it Stepford Wives-like, or is it like badly behaved kids at a boarding school?
A little Handmaid's Tale in
a little bit.
Yeah, it's definitely like a YA
young adult
audience
thing.
The director, Alice Waddington, is she's Spanish, and she was a costume director. So I think a lot of care has been taken
with
costumes, set design, mood, whether or not the script holds up.
It's
a question.
The characters aren't interesting either, I just might say.
And a few good actresses. Emma Roberts, Awkwafina, Danielle McDonald, who was fabulous in Patty Cakes. Yep. You remember her?
Yeah.
We have a clip here, Steve. What is it?
Emma Roberts' character wakes up in this retreat, in this island retreat, and is kind of asking, where the heck am I?
This is from Paradise Hills.
I didn't mean to startle you. Breakfast is on its way.
Breakfast? I mean, where am I?
You're in paradise, of course.
That's from Paradise Hills, but don't go see it. Yeah.
Well, it opens at Screenland today, and Manos opens at Alamo today.
And it's at Screenland as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. That's our rundown for this week. We were joined today by our film critics, Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Beck Ireland. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. Yesterday in the show, we learned how extremists are influencing politics and our national conversation through social media. That and other previous episodes, you'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. You can find and follow us on Twitter. We're at kcuruptodate. Follow me at Steve Kraske, and don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. Monday on the show, is our approach to cancer treatment all wrong? Most drugs on the market prolong life by mere months at huge physical and financial costs. We'll ask if there's a better way. Our theme music is composed by the great Bobby Watson. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Maria Carter, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Elizabeth Ruiz, and Jamie Hobbs. Have a great weekend, all. Go Chiefs! I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.